It's 6 o'clock, so we will call the meeting to order. Thank you all for attending. As a reminder, we decided last meeting that in the absence of Chair Gears and Vice Chair Fernandez, that I will act as chair for this meeting. So the first thing we have on the agenda is the roll call. I already noted that the chair and vice chair are absent. Commissioner O'Connor has also said that he will not attend. So I'll run through the rest of the roll call. Commissioner Jared?
Here.
Commissioner Hauser?
Here.
Commissioner Nesfield?
Here.
Commissioner Nyland?
Here.
Commissioner Rose?
Here.
Commissioner Sund? Oh. On his way, maybe. Commissioner Young?
Here.
So we'll move to approval of the agenda, withdrawals and continuances.
So many.
So we have a motion to approve in a second.
Second.
Are there any questions or comments on the agenda as presented? Hearing none, I'll call for a vote. All in favor of approval of the agenda?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? No, it passes unanimously. Move to the next item, approval of the minutes. The action will be approving the September 5th, 2019 meeting minutes. Everybody should have a copy. Please take a minute to review. And again, we'll need a motion in a second. Can we note that Commissioner Sund is in attendance? That's it.
I'll make the motion to approve the minutes submitted.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Is there any comments or changes needed? Chris, do you want to read them before I call them?
No, I looked at them prior.
Okay, great. Okay, we'll call for the vote then. All in favor of approving the minutes?
Aye.
Any opposed? It passes unanimously. Next item, citizen comments. Do we have any citizens in attendance?
Yes, I am here in attendance. As a former Glendale employee, so.
Would you like 3 minutes to provide comments?
How about 3 seconds? Great to see the people that I knew from a year and a half ago when I retired, and other than that, it's always been a great group.
Excellent. Well, happy to have you. Thank you for doing this. Okay, so we will move on to our next item, which is fleet electrification. Big word. Patrick.
Chair Fundus and Commissioners, Robert Perez has joined us from the Field Operations Department this evening. He's going to discuss the city's program to convert at least parts of the service vehicle fleet to electric vehicles. As background, the Commission has requested information on the city's efforts to support or use electric vehicle technology. In addition to tonight's presentation, our expectation is that there'll be future agenda items to provide additional information on various aspects of this topic. And this item is on tonight's agenda for information and discussion. With that, I'll turn it over to Robert.
My name is Robert Perez. I'm the Business Operations Analyst for Field Operations Department. I just want to start off by saying I appreciate this opportunity to share a little bit about what Field Operation does with you guys, specifically with regards to our new initiative to incorporate electric vehicles into the fleet. So, thank you. So, let's go ahead and start off with the discussion items for tonight. So, I figured as an introduction to the commission that I would start off with basically an overview of what it is that we're doing, and of course we could parse into details. To begin with, the incorporation of electric vehicles started with a pilot that we were doing. And we figured with some of the data that we were getting from our utilization study, that now was the time to start incorporating them into the fleet. And we did so. We'll also go over the implementation plan, as well as the impact we've already observed, and then of course what our future plans are. So with our utilization study, basically it was a study to find out if we're making effective use of the city's fleet. So in other words, is our fleet sized to what the business need for the vehicles are? With an initial study that we had done about a year ago, it provided initial insights that pointed to right around the 200 mark, where we may have oversized fleet and we needed to basically right-size it to, again, business need. We ran two different phases. The first phase was actually within our own department first. So field operations includes the landfill, solid waste facilities, and fleet department. And basically we took a handful of vehicles from each division, parked them for a 90-day period, studied the effects. In the first phase, we found that the average driving radius was about 5.6 miles. And this was across all four divisions. With our second phase, this was with development services, which includes our code compliance as well as our building safety divisions. Incorporated the same data analysis and discovered that their driving radius was about 15.1 miles. So combined between both phases, average driving radius was about 10.35 miles, which basically pointed us in the direction where we knew we were going to go, but we needed the data to back it up. So that being said, one of the things that is a challenge when incorporating things like electric vehicles into fleets is what's called or referred to as, let's go ahead and start off with the implementation portion of it first. So basically, we had ordered electric vehicles at the beginning of the fiscal year. And we had intentions of incorporating them into the fleet. We just needed to kind of parse in which the number of vehicles to kind of start bringing into the fleet, specifically with moving our people around. So not so much job duties and functions, but for the purposes of travel. So we started off with two electric vehicles, and we gave one to our code compliance and then the other to our police department.
What model were those? Just curious.
We will get to that in a moment. Okay. It comes with a nice graphic, so
good.
We'll leave you guys in suspense for a bit. So one of the challenges when incorporating EVs, and this is not just in local government, it's also in the private sector, is what's referred to as range anxiety. So am I going to be able to drive around all day, or am I going to run out of battery and have to charge it up with my cell phone? You know, those sorts of things. So what we found is it was sort of like a two-pronged effort. Number one, we identified already, again from data gathered, that the average trips were well within electric vehicles' range. And on average, with the vehicle type that we selected, it's about 180 miles worth of driving range between charges. That being said, we did an educational portion where when we selected the departments to go and receive the first electric vehicles, we went over these things and reassured them that this is well within the typical driving radius for what they will typically do on a daily basis, not to mention we were already putting the infrastructure in place to have them charging during the day when they were not being used. That being said, the other aspect of it is it's a non-traditional vehicle, so of course anything that's new is a little scary just because you don't know too much about it. So that being said, the impacts that we were looking at were obviously environmental. So, you know, no emissions, it's environmentally friendly. And of course, if we don't need to, we don't need to add to vehicle emissions if we don't have to. Fun little factoid with electric vehicles, They take about twice the amount of emissions to create, but over the lifetime of the vehicle, they will create about half the emissions of your typical internal combustion engine. The other aspect of it was taking a look at the financial aspect, which would include the operating and maintenance costs. Obviously, less moving parts, less maintenance. And we'll kind of touch on what we're looking for data-wise in the future in a moment. And then, of course, the being good stewards to the city with EVs, they're actually pretty reasonable in price, not to mention, again, by lowering the overall cost of the life cycle of keeping that vehicle, we're saving the city money, especially for something as simple as just moving our people around. So these are the electric vehicles. It's the Nissan Leaf. And brand new, in my opinion, I think they look pretty great, especially compared to the way EVs looked when they first came out, kind of goofy looking. Apparently some of the feedback that we've gotten is they're smooth rides, quiet, and you know, it's exactly what we're trying to promote, is to create that buy-in amongst our employees, so that as we incorporate more of them, again, we will just kind of increase the positive outlook when it comes to incorporating these into department fleets. So, a couple of things. We have officially four EVs deployed into the fleet. Again, one in our police department for our PIO, one in code compliance, and we have two in the motor pool, one here at the fleet and then the other at the city hall. We have four chargers installed, and our future plans is to incorporate five electric vehicles per fiscal year. So, and again, this is incremental. So we kind of want to bring these in smaller numbers, and then as we start seeing the positive impacts, again, use the data to justify the purchasing of, you know, potentially larger amounts. And what we're doing, what we're actually doing different, is Glendale's unique in that we are going to be studying the overall life cycle cost from the very beginning, from the purchase of the vehicle. I've been to three different sustainability conferences with some big players in the valley like SRP and City of Phoenix, Tempe, APS. They've all been incorporating electric vehicles into their fleets. One of the hugest issues is that nobody's collected verifiable vetted data from the beginning. So while they have estimates of what the overall cost is, nobody actually has citable evidence of that. So when it comes to other cities and they want to take a look at, okay, if we want to incorporate EVs, what is it going to cost us over the life cycle of the vehicle? We will be the first in the valley to actually be able to prove that. So a couple of policies we put into place. Every single EV that comes into the fleet is getting outfitted with a GPS unit from the very beginning. So we're going to be tracking its daily utilization. We'll be taking a look at it on an annual basis to see if we can incorporate these again in larger numbers. But again, using data collected as we move along. So this is going to be kind of like a progressive implementation, if you will. Also, in addition to analyzing the data over an extended, over the life cycle of the vehicle, we're also incorporating the ability to change our project plans. So again, as we collect data and create that justification, again, the goal is to incorporate these in larger numbers, and then of course the infrastructure behind it. So with that, if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
I have a couple.
Yes.
First, how many of these do you plan on getting in total over time?
As many as Business Eve will allow. Again, if we can take, this is a process of, again, using GPS information to verify the vehicle's usage, the utilization over time. So, for example, we utilize the majority of the fleet is basically used for is light duty. So basically your cars, pickup trucks, full-size trucks, what have you. Now, if a vehicle's use is, if the justification for the vehicle type is used for the completion of their daily duties, it's a little different than just using it to go from point A to point B. So what we're trying to target is to take a look at the vehicle's utilization and say, what are you using the vehicle for? When we start identifying the average use per day, per week, per year on vehicles, and the majority of the usage is for the purpose of travel, that vehicle is going to get converted. So the thing is, right now, the GPS initiative is just something that we put into place at the end of last year, and we've been incorporating larger numbers of GPS units within probably the last 3 to 4 months. So until we have at least, you know, 6-7 months worth of, again, vetted data, it's a little hard to put a number just yet until we kind of have that data to back up pulling cars or converting them.
What's the typical lifespan of one of these vehicles?
The typical lifespan in the consumer market, because again, with the city, it's sort of new, so we kind of need to see operationally how these things work, especially with our particular usage. But in the consumer market, typically it's between 8 and 9 years. So hopefully we're estimating the same, or even, you know, potentially better if we still see kind of this underutilization, as you saw, you know, 5-10 miles worth of driving. So it, again, we just kind of gotta wait for the data to roll in, and then we'll make better decisions about that.
So that five, I'm sorry, am I monopolizing the question base here? That five vehicles you're going to get per year, that's correct. Ongoing, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so when the first five vehicles that you bought in 2020 get to their 10-year cycle, are you going to use that five vehicle quota to replace them, or are you going to replace them and get an additional five?
My hope is to be doing it on a cyclic basis. So not wait until 10 years to go from 5 to 10 vehicles per year. My goal is to gather the data and show that if we can prove that we can incorporate larger numbers, let's kind of do that on an ongoing basis. So for example, so this year, obviously we're planning for 5 vehicles for the next fiscal year. Potentially after that, we can increase it, 6 vehicles, 7 vehicles. So it's gonna kind of depend on the velocity in which we collect the data and can start implementing the additional vehicles as vehicles are needed or replaced based on the vehicle replacement plan.
All right, one more question, I swear to you. For the you said you have 2 in circulation with the police department. Are these going to be used as police vehicles, or are they just going to be other kinds of transportation for them?
No. We actually have just one with the police department.
Okay,
and it was specifically with the PIO. And it was, that was also kind of a two-pronged approach. Number one, because, again, the primary use of the vehicle for travel, not for duty use, if you will. Mm-hmm. Secondly, to actually self-promote for us, because everyone's going to see the great rap on that car. It's going to catch your attention, and we're going to basically help promote it within the city, within the fleet, within the community. We have electric vehicles. So it's kind of like advertising, if you will, for us as well. So again, to kind of create the buy-in within the city and, of course, in the community.
Okay. All right. I'm done.
Great questions.
Do these cars have any noise so that you don't sneak up on the pedestrians?
Okay. Great question. Fun little factoid about most electric vehicles. The noises you hear are actually audio created.
Yeah.
So a lot of them will actually play them through speakers to create sound so that you can hear it as it's moving.
Yeah.
So they actually produce very little sound. Most of it is actually fake noise that you're hearing that's created.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's weird.
Yes, sir.
Robert, the noise that's created, by the way, it's like your TV. You know, I rode it in Tesla recently, and there's nothing. He turned his off, so it's kind of cool. 3 questions.
Yes,
one
sir.
Is, right now on the streets of Glendale, public vehicles that are transport vehicles that you're talking about by category. Number right now in service?
Total? Of electric vehicles?
No. Total number of vehicles the city has on the
streets. Oh, total number of vehicles
that are transportation
is about 1,300 vehicles citywide.
Okay. The impact to the economy of the city, or if you will, the budget, will be measurable in this particular case. Huge.
Yes.
So the measure of that impact, the acceleration from 5 to maybe 50, will be a directive of the result of your economic analysis.
Correct.
So my question then comes, in the buying of the whatever, the Leafs or the Maples or whatever they are, obviously the buying power is extreme when you buy larger numbers.
Yes.
And putting them out to a competitive bid. Have you given any thought to the approach you're going to use when you decide to accelerate as far as putting it out to bid?
The way I would respond to that is I think that would be a decision for our fleet superintendent, because obviously the strategy around vehicle purchases is absolutely under his purview. So I'd be reserved to answer on his behalf, but I mean that it would make logical sense.
Yeah. Well, the PR is one thing, but the impact of one city mm-hmm. who's taking it from the very beginning. No other cities around us that have much more broader alignments budget-wise and so forth are not doing that, but we're doing it here. The impact of that seems to me to be relevant to the purchasing. Let's say I own Nissan. If Glendale was the city that saves $15 million in budget a year on my cars, I want to promote that. So that's worth a lot to me. So as a vendor, if you are a manufacturer. So that, I was just bringing that up only as a question, because that has to be in the beginning conversations, I think, also in your discussions with your supervisors and transportation people, because that's going to have a huge impact on dollars spent. The third question I have is that the sharing of this information with other municipalities, because of the high pollution we have in the valley, transport, particularly with, if Glendale has 1,300, I can just imagine, take it times 20 cities. How many do we really have on the roads pushing out the emissions every day? So the intent would be, I would assume, on Glendale's part, to share the information. And do you have that in your plan to do that?
Yes, absolutely. Again, visiting these sustainability conferences, it's been very apparent. And with all three that I've been to, it's the same questions from newer folks that aren't familiar with some of these conferences and summits. Is can you give us some numbers of overall cost? And it's the same thing at every single one of them. Nobody has that kind of data. Mm-hmm. So again, when this was put in place, I had an extended conversation with our director, Michelle, and Montana, our superintendent. And I let them know that this is something that's going to be critically important to Glendale, because this is something that we're going to be able to do for other cities that no other city, or even, again, these private entities that they fail to do for the city. So that will be our service to our community.
Okay. My last question is, have you given any consideration to potential partnerships in the area of the charging stations themselves?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Short answer, yes. Long answer is the negotiations back and forth. So there are incentives that, for example, like APS will put out as far as partnering with us to help cover the cost of the installation of a charging station. As you can imagine, there is quite a few different, pieces to those kinds of agreements where there will be stipulations, like it will have to be public facing, where you get to share with the public, not just, you know, your own internal vehicles, that sort of thing. So those things are being vetted out again with our superintendent, and APS is definitely one of the bigger partners that has stepped up to partner with us to do exactly those things. So there is a plan being put in place to expand it just from our city's utilization for our EVs and putting them in strategic places throughout the city where we can share it not just with our internal fleet, but as well as the community.
Such places as the rideshare allocation acreages where there's ride share lots? Is that one of those considerations?
The specific places, I don't have an answer on, unfortunately, because again, these are still in the conversational phase. But again, what I can assure you is there is some public information that has been available where some studies were done of taking a look at a map of the city and taking a look at strategic places where, you know, again, it would have the most public-facing location and kind of incentivize the local community to come out to these places, charge their vehicles, visit around local shops, you know, things like that. So again, these are all things that we're evaluating.
Okay. Are you, sorry, this is the same question, it's just pizzas. Sounds like I got 10 questions, but the partnerships out there that are not the APSs, but large employment centers like the hospitals and large employers themselves that are non-medical, as well as some companies. One of the considerations I would hope would be that the city would look at inviting maybe a forum together of these people to see who would step up and have an interest and be a part of this from the very beginning. Because as this trend moves, I see more people buying these now, and the insurance rates are different, believe it or not. I commuted to this meeting tonight from Maricopa. I had a client in Maricopa, and I commuted. I left there at 3 o'clock, and I got here and be at the meeting. But it was not an easy. It never is. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're over there at 3 o'clock, you can kiss 2 hours goodbye. So if I had an electric vehicle, of course, I wouldn't be polluting. But next to me in a car was a woman with a mask all the way up to her eyes because she couldn't take the emissions. So it was kind of interesting. It was a very beautiful little thing she had on, but it was to protect her from the fumes. So a lot of people out there, I think, that would have an interest in being in the discussion phase if you decide to go that direction, just a thought.
Absolutely. Just to add on to that, I actually just facilitated an environmental summit the other week. With this initiative, the environmental impact we had was saving about 313 metric tons of emissions.
Wow. Wow.
In the initial right sizing that we did from these two pilots. So
yeah, that's huge. I got to congratulate you. You're way down the road, I think.
Thank you.
I don't know how long you've been working on this, but I'm really impressed.
About a year.
Yeah, about a year. Okay. Yeah.
Commissioner Nyland, we appreciated your interest in initiating this discussion. That's why we're bringing it to you tonight. And we do expect this to be kind of an ongoing topic where we can continue educating the commission and also continue the momentum for the city to move towards adoption of the electric vehicle opportunity. So
we'll with be that, looking forward to seeing the results of the analysis.
Yeah.
I'm excited to see all that.
Yeah, I'm excited too.
Yeah.
It's going to be huge. The city will have another rainy day fund.
Any other questions?
Yeah, real quick, what's the normal mileage or lifespan for a combustion vehicle that we have in the city? What's the normal lifespan there? Do we go by mileage, or is it going by that 8 to 9 years?
Well, Chairman, Commissioners, it's a little bit of both, depending on the vehicle type. In short, the most efficient vehicle as far as life cycle operational costs is actually a passenger vehicle. As you get into pickups, full-size trucks, the life cycle actually drops because the older a truck gets, the utilization of a truck, like for example, for again duties, they take more wear and tear than a passenger car that just gets used for travel. So it does differ. It's a combination of things, basically make, model, your purchase, average miles driven per year, number of trips per week. It's also inclusive of the vehicle type, again, shorter age with the larger vehicles, as well as its use and department deployment, so depending which department it goes to. So it's kind of a combination of a lot of aggregate data.
And the follow-up question to that is typically a lot of the city vehicles are American-made vehicles with Chevy and Ford and whatnot.
Correct.
So mainly because of maintenance, we're using similar parts in fixing things and whatnot. So what made us choose Nissan and going to a different company like that?
The overwhelming reason was the price, the purchase price. It's significantly lower than its competition. So for us, we'd rather save the money, purchase more vehicles.
Sure.
And you know what, not to mention, I could actually add on to that is, it also has a really good reputation for the purposes of fleet use. Mm-hmm. So again,
cool.
Reputation, yeah. Price.
They do look cool, they look great.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Any more questions? Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Very informative.
Thanks, Robert.
I think our next item is Glendale Family Bike Lane.
Chair Fundus and Commissioners, Trevor has joined us tonight. Everybody knows Trevor. He's addressed you guys on a number of occasions. He's here tonight to discuss options regarding the future of the Glendale Family Bike Lane.
Great, thank you.
Chair Fundus and Commissioners, this item is on tonight's agenda for information, discussion, and possible action.
Tighten up my chair.
There you go.
Okay, thank you, Chair and Commissioners. This is a story about our Glendale Family Bike Ride, and we have history with the bike ride and the evolution of it, our expenses associated with it, and we have different dynamics going on, different areas of focus that are requiring our attention. So I want to talk to you about all that and get your opinion so that I can take back to council what your suggestions are. We've got about 20 years of history with the Glendale Family Bike Ride. It actually goes a little further than that, back to the late 90s, I think, is about as far as we can track it. So we captured some of it here, and we only went back about 5 years to 2015. So as you can see, in 2015, we spent about $15,000 that's excluding staff, transportation staff time. But we spent about $15,000 on vendors, different amenities for the bike ride. And then in 2019, this past April 1st, March 31st, we spent $45,000. So as you can see, the cost is steadily increased, and we did that by design. We did that thinking that the ridership, the participants, would proportionally increase along with what we spent on it. That hasn't really been the case. You can see the gold line at the bottom. We started out in 2015 with about 500 people participating, and in 2019 we had about 900 people participating. So the ridership is about a 73% increase. The cost is about a 188% increase. So something to note on the blue line, the expense that does not cover the transportation staff to manage the event. So we spend approximately $50,000 in staff time just to run this event, on top of the $45,000 for the associated assets with the event. So what we're finding is we have needs. We have needs. We have pedestrian crashes involved with vehicles that are on the rise. We have issues with speed. We have other outreach that we need, that we're being drawn attention towards. So the driver awareness. This pie representation here is showing you the proportionate share of where the transportation education fund is being allocated. So $45,000 of it, totals about $65,000. So $45,000 of it is being allocated to the bike ride, Glendale Family Bike Ride. And then $14,000 towards pedestrian education, $100 towards our crossing guard training, $800 towards our driver safety campaign, and $2,600 to our public outreach. We're wanting to kind of flip that and divert the majority of our attention to the driver awareness. As you all know, the distracted driving is a major topic right now. The Arizona state of Arizona has passed the hands-free device only. So we're not equipped enough to handle that type of a education program unless we make some changes. Those changes are what we're proposing to you, and we'd like your feedback on. Our concerns are a lot of pedestrian-involved crashes. The speeds are increasing. We have opportunity to educate drivers. We're currently working with our third graders to teach them how to cross the street safely, how to walk their bike safely, things like that. And we have an opportunity to get into like the 10th grade, the new drivers, the 16-year-olds that just got their licenses. And we have 7 high schools in Glendale. So we can potentially get into those 10th grade areas or classrooms and help implement programs that educate our new drivers on driver awareness, distracted driving. We've done some outreach to local companies that are experts in facilitating driver safety programs. One is a driving MLB,
NBA.
Driving MBA. They have a recreational vehicle that's been converted to a simulator. It's a car simulator. So they brought it onto the property here, and several transportation staff went through that simulation, and they can implement guaranteed crashes or distractions to educate the drivers on how to react. That driving MBA company also attended the last year's Touch a Truck program that is run by the city out at the Gila River Arena, and the kids passed through that recreational vehicle, the simulator, and it was a pretty good attraction. There's other programs where consultants can come in and facilitate training in a classroom environment, or we could adopt a program where we get new drivers onto a road course. We've reached out to a few companies that are out of state. One is called BRAKE. I forgot the acronym of BRAKE. They have a driving program similar to what the police have on their skid course. They teach people how to react to individual incidents that occur in front of them. So we're thinking that the driver awareness outreach programs are where we need to focus more attention on. So that's the driver safety education. The active transportation plan, this is an area that you guys have heard a lot about in the past. The ATP, or active transportation plan, has just been completed, and it identified gaps where pedestrian and bicycle enhancements could be made for safety. So through our driver safety education and our active transportation plan, we feel the pedestrians and the bicyclists are going to receive an appropriate amount of attention, but we need to focus more on the drivers themselves. Some of our available resources are, we have education staff. We have 1 3/4. One FTE, full-time employee, that's Dory Ludwig sitting over here, and she has a temporary staff. 3/4 out of 3/4 staff?
Point five?
Okay. There's one full-time staff manning all these programs, and that's very limited resources to be so diversified. So it's going to require an enormous amount of time for Dory to facilitate the driver awareness programs. We also have limited budget in the education program. There's $190,000 allocated for the transportation education component, and we would like to use every available dollar on redistributing it towards driver awareness. We need to prioritize. Our prioritization here, we feel, is a little unbalanced. We need to refocus that into driver awareness rather than bicycle and pedestrian. So what can we do? This is where we need your suggestions so I can take back to council. We can either, yes, sir.
Well, Trevor, I was just thinking about something. A few, about, I think it might have been last year, there was like a safety program at one of the shopping centers in my area. I was thinking if the if this were brought into it, I think a lot of people find out like what's going on. I think a lot of people would come to the program.
For the driver safety?
Right.
Great. I'm not sure which program you're referring to that was at the shopping center.
It was a safety program by the, I think, mainly City of Phoenix and also some people from Glendale.
Okay. Okay. Well, that, I would agree. That'd be great. The public outreach, the getting the message out. Dory's implemented a driver awareness, driver safety campaign in coordination with our police department on the dynamic message signs, but we need to do more. So the things that we can do, and we need your suggestions with the bike ride in specific. We're spending over $90,000 to get 900 people coming to this event. That's about $100 per person that we're spending for the bike ride. So we can either go status quo, run the bike ride as we did last year, at again a $90,000 expenditure, or we can reduce the footprint, make the bike ride smaller, reduce the staff, the police and fire support, and the amenities involved with the bike ride, or we can eliminate it. And eliminate meaning maybe it's a pilot, maybe we stop it for a year to see what we can do with, as far as a driver awareness program. We'll also be able to identify what kind of ramifications we get from that, what kind of telephone calls we're going to receive because we canceled the bike ride. So those are three options that we can do with the existing bike ride, and I'd like your feedback on how you feel about all of that information.
Do you have any more detail on the breakdown of the $90,000 of costs? Like what was being used for, what specifically in the bike ride? I think that would be helpful information for the group to see.
Okay. Yes, sir.
I know going to it last year, I know the t-shirts were a big part of it. I know they gave away a lot of helmets and stuff like that, so maybe just get back to maybe a grassroots type of it and
right.
Scratch the t-shirt part of it. I mean, give something, but I mean, let's really cut down on the cost of it.
Well, why can't you just get some kind of sponsorship thing with the t-shirts? Like, I know, I remember when we were there, if you had signed up before, now I went for, Dory knows, a couple of years. This year was the first year I missed in the last couple of years, and I've been volunteering for that bike ride and helping out. And I noticed that if you pre-registered, you got a nice t-shirt that just said Glendale Family Bike Ride. But if you did not, you got a t-shirt that said Glendale Family Bike Ride on one side and Wells Fargo or something on the back. So why couldn't you just do a total sponsorship and throw it out there for the universe to see who would sponsor the t-shirts for the advertising rights? I mean, that would cut out one of your costs. Me personally, I've seen the whole dynamic with the families and stuff, and I think it would be really sad if we totally eliminate it. And I understand the need for the cost and everything, but why can't we just go back to the way it was? You know, last year was a really big thing. I don't know what it was like this year, but they had the bouncy house and the music and all kinds of stuff. So why couldn't you just tone it down a little bit?
And that's an option. And to your point of seeking sponsorships, that requires a lot of time. Just with the existing bike ride, she starts programming of this event 7 months in advance.
Yeah, I know. When we were in CBAC, she was coming to the meetings.
7 months for a one-day event. Mm-hmm. That's a full-time employee. So that's not even really pushing for the sponsorships. That would require even more attention. Yes, sir.
I have a few thoughts here, Trevor. I see this as part of the community fabric. I do not see Viber Education as a role that this department should play by itself. That's number one. The community fabric that we have in Glendale is unique. The threat count continues to go down on the community fabric because we keep pulling things off the roster that makes the community a community. 2 weeks ago, I heard that the chocolate affair is on the block to be gone. So that's another piece of community that's going to be gone if it happens.
They cut the Christmas thing, too.
There's lots of things going on right now because of budgetary structure. 2 years ago, I bought up sponsorships. So for this event to cost $90,000 by lumping in that $50,000 salary piece, I think pull the $50,000 salary piece out and then look at the fact that you have in this community plenty of people who will put their name on something and pay. Put an RFP out, my suggestion would be, to the public to have somebody go out and get your sponsors. I know three people that do that right now for other entities. And you'll have the money you need to run this bike festival. I predict that you'll have more money than you need for this. Not bicycle shops. I'm not talking those kind of people. The caliber of bike riders that we have in our community varies from the little guys that drive their bikes to the schools every day and lock them up to the people that ride their bikes every day to work. And there was a time, I remember when Jim McAllister was councilman, that's when it all started back in the 90s, and that's how this bike thing started, really, because of Jim. He was a biker. We had no bike trails, we had no bike lanes, we had nothing on the streets of Glendale. Then we became bicycle friendly, and we got those things accomplished. And most neighborhoods now have a trail that you can ride your bike in. It's much more safe than the general street. I see people on the freeway on their bikes, I think they're crazy. Motorcycles, those are even crazy. But I believe that there are plenty of people out there who will step up to this. And I can give you a roster of people that I know, if I went and made the phone calls, would sign up, okay? And if you put the RFP out, I'll be real frank about it, my company will apply. But that's one piece, I think, where we'll eliminate your costs as far as the stuff that you need. The other piece is, if you did a roster and showed every school in Glendale that has a bicycle yard and how many cyclists they get every day, that would be a number that I think that would be important for the staff person to have in her possession if she doesn't already, because that field of people has got to be a lot more than 900 with all these kids riding bikes. I have Legend Springs, which is literally, I can throw a stone and hit it almost. They have a huge bicycle yard now, and all these little schools in Deer Valley School District, each district should be a part of this too, in my opinion. Every school district should be a part of driver education too. Pardon me. Another thought or another suggestion about the community fabric is that when I went to school, and that was a long time ago, you had driver education in the classroom, and there were dealerships who furnished the car and the driver. The school didn't have to pay for it. But every kid got the opportunity to become educated on how to drive. Today, we need to do driver education for everybody, I think. But we had some education that happened a few months ago on the red light crossing and a red light study that was done at 59th and Bell. The message that was sent out by council, and I'll put it right where I see it, was it's wide open. We don't really care about what happened there. In 1 month, if I'm not wrong, it was over 30,000 incidents of people going through the red light. We voted not to implement even the trial basis red lights, cameras, to keep those incidents down. So to me, do we have a consciousness in the community of our council about safety and driver education and protecting our environment, if you will, of people who are growing in the driver pool, if you will. We have more people coming online every day. We have over 100,000 families in Glendale. Most of them drive their cars or have bicycles. We don't have a lot of bicycle shops, but we got places to buy. You can buy a bicycle, you know, with the Walmarts and everybody else. But I guarantee you that you'll get the sponsors to underwrite this. That's number one. So I would suggest that. But the consciousness of the council, in my opinion, also, they need to be brought in. And I would propose some kind of a forum workshop where you put people in play in each district and have the district council involved to get the people out to support driver education. And there's car dealers here in our city, but there's car dealers adjacent that'll support driver education. They've gotten away from it. They don't have it anymore. We pay people now to educate our kids how to drive. And it's not cheap. It's expensive, you know, to pay them. But the insurance people also need to be brought on board. And that's another opinion I have, because I have some experience there. You get a video, your kid reads that, you get a 15% discount. He doesn't have to drive anything. He just has to watch the video. What kind of education is that, you know? So those are personal peeves that I have as far as driver education is concerned. But I think the bicycle family thing is a part of the community fabric that should be protected, should be strengthened. And if it's budgetary, I believe that that can be addressed with the private sector partnerships. And I might be totally all wet and wrong, but I think it could be. Because you've got a Coca-Cola company here that sells a lot of Cokes in our community. You got the Khalil boys down in Tucson who support everything I ever went and asked them to do.
Walmart.
Here in Glendale, Walmart.
Wells Fargo.
A lot of people, you know. So I appreciate it. It takes a lot of time to do that. So, and the staff person on the city side, it's a difficult role for them to go out and ask for sponsorships. So there's an opportunity to use a private independent contractor who puts the best thing in front of you to make it work. And they have to make it work. And that could happen, I think, really in our city. That's my opinion.
Okay.
I want to bring up the point that almost every city around us does some kind of family bicycle thing around the same time because of that Arizona Bike Month or whatever it is. So do we really want to be... Well, and I remember this from when we were in CBAC. We talked about making Glendale a biking destination, you know, putting it out there that this is a bike-friendly city. Come here, come to Glendale, come and visit, stay Arizona, stay in Glendale. You could ride your bike around and get places. Do we really want to be the ones that are the only ones that don't have it?
Right.
I mean, you know, I feel really strongly about this. I don't really want to see it go away.
But you want that proportion of that, our education, I mean, component being spent, yeah, on a bike ride.
Sure, well, in this micro view, that's, I recognize that that's tough. And that's, but looking at the macro perspective of the city, yeah, seeing the family events being canceled is frustrating from a citizen's perspective.
Sure.
We'll have 900 more frustrated citizens.
And I like the RFP idea. And you touched on something, Commissioner Nyland, that I just wanted to, I know you have a question as well. But you touched on the intersection safety. Council's well aware and on board with increasing the intersection safety. Glendale has 12 of the top 100 most dangerous intersections in the Maricopa County.
Yeah.
So council's aware of that and doing what they can to support us in improving those locations. And that's all the more reason we feel it is to support or educate drivers.
But I don't think that's the total answer. We all took the driving test and everything like that. And you know what? Everybody knows the rules of the road. Driver education is not the answer.
Trevor, we have a real vacancy, I think, on the enforcement side. And I bring this up every time I'm in front of a uniformed officer and on occasion the past chief. We do not have the numbers of people to address the violations that's occurring every day in our streets. The speeding is number one. I have councilmen now that are putting signs in their constituents' yards that says, drive like your kid lives here. Drive safely like your kid lives here. And anybody can buy that sign online, but they buy local from somebody that's about half the price. they feel strong enough as a council person to give those away to people, to slow people, make people think a little bit, you know. So I think the driver safety part of it is it's a good piece. However, I don't think that one thing drives what you're doing here and shouldn't drive it, because you're talking about public safety, which is our police department that needs to do more, maybe, and step up to bat on the driver education. But the insurance companies need to do the same thing. The car dealers will probably, if they were asked, would say, sure, you know, what's one car? But the districts, all of them, don't offer anything of that nature, you know. So we're kind of a mixed up world right now, I think, out there when it comes to drivers. And I'm on the road every day. I do about 100 plus miles a day, and it's not good. I do get stressed. My blood pressure goes up, I know. If I can avoid being on the other side, I'm over here after 2 o'clock. But that's the challenge we have as communities. And the bicycle thing, I went into a bicycle shop to get 3 bicycles repaired that I've had in my storage. And I said, here's what I need done. He says, why don't you just buy new ones? I said, how much are they? He told me. I said, because all 3 of those together didn't cost what one of those cost. And these are nice, pretty little bikes, and they're like $450 a piece. And so my bikes were like $50 a piece, you know, and I bought them at Walmart, and they're fine bikes. So I think the bicycle industry is alive and well in Glendale. Getting them connected through various marketing approaches with the schools particularly might be one thing to consider if it hasn't been done already. Because I think parents that link in and support their child taking their bike to work, or basically to school, would support, you know. Do we charge an entry fee for the bicycle race?
No.
Nothing at all. Do we ask for a donation?
No.
Okay. Well, another suggestion. Open it up. Whoever wants to support, become part of the bicycle club. You know, everybody has a rewards program. So why not with the bicycles? You know, if you want to ride, become part That's of our bicycle club. And the city of Glendale then recognizes there's 1,500 kids out there that are under 10 riding bicycles. Future drivers on the roads, you know, whatever, some recognition program or something.
Right.
But I think also what she said about Wells Fargo, the T-shirts, hats, helmets, all those things, they'll all be paid for by your private sector.
Okay. Commissioner Sun?
Manpower-wise, I mean, working for another city, I know we don't talk well with other groups in our city, so police and fire, they always have recruit classes going on that are always looking for volunteer-type things to work on and be part of, so I know that would be a big part of that. We have Glendale Community College too that has fire and police science stuff that they're always looking for community service type stuff to volunteer for as well. So
and we use the explorers, we use the volunteers that we can, as many as we can. The sworn officers are required to control the mm-hmm. intersections themselves,
sure.
as well as patrol the ride, and then fire supports the ride as well.
Sure. I just know a lot of them are look for community service events during while they're in their recruit classes and whatnot. So I mean, I think that would be a good thing to maybe reach out to police or fire. Maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be ready to take action on this meeting.
Mm-hmm. That's fine. I have a breakdown here of if you don't mind grouping it into certain categories. Not counting transportation staff, we spend $11,000, just over $11,000 on staff. That's police and fire. We spend almost $12,000 on rentals and services. About $3,500 on signs and banners. And about $17,000 on giveaways and printed materials. And there's, I guess, $700 on food and the rest stops.
That's all part of that $45,000, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. $800 on miscellaneous supplies and $300 on printing.
Do you know what parts of that budget have increased over time? Like you were showing us, was that from 2014 or 2015 that on a previous slide?
Dory?
Yeah, it's the activities at the park. We increased the activities at the park to draw more participants as well as some of the giveaways. So we have a keepsake medal. A couple years ago we brought like the activities in the park, we increased that significantly to try to bring a draw. So in case maybe families had young kids didn't want to go on the bike ride, like we had a little bike rodeo set up, we had different activities, so they can come still get the information, learn about bicycle safety, and still be a part of the event, but not necessarily maybe they could or couldn't go on the ride. So
I was just curious. I remember you now coming in talking about the free helmets. What do those helmets cost per unit?
Well, the helmets actually were free because they were funded through a grant.
Through a grant, okay. Yes. If I could put my name on the helmet and write you a check, would you take it? The check? Sure you would. If it's a sponsor, one company that takes care of all the helmets, you know, however you want to do it. But I think people, if they had an opportunity to walk to that bike race and buy a helmet at a reduced price because it's subsidized by a vendor, for example, we use Redflex or somebody like that, they probably buy a helmet and be more safe. And then you recoup the money there too.
Right.
You know, you don't sell anything at the event.
We don't. Everything's free.
It's giveaway. I think we gave away 400 helmets last year.
Yeah. So
we brought in exhibitors that they give away items. We require them to have an interactive information, and then they have items that they give away, safety items typically.
Yeah. See, in Glendale, you got almost 8,000 businesses. I can tell you right now, 10 of them write the check for that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And
I have what I need to go move forward.
We're being recorded, right?
When is the council going to be meeting on this?
As soon as I set up a workshop.
Are you going to invite anybody here to the workshop?
You guys are always invited to the workshop. We'll definitely let you know when that workshop will be, okay, so you can attend if you want.
Yeah, because some of us have opinions on this that need to be heard.
Sure. Yeah, the family events are the downtown events are a hot topic.
Oh, yeah. Right now. Well, yeah, I think anything family is so important to the community. Some things you're not going to make your expenses on, we know that, but it's part of the community. You know, it's part of what city you do. That's why you live in certain cities, you know. We're not the according to everything I read now, we're not poor anymore.
Perhaps did you ask?
I just wanted to make a note that while any one of us can attend the workshop, workshops are where council does not take
public comment.
So if you have any comments to make, I would share them so that at least there's a way for us to get that.
So we share it here to get it in front of council. Then we come back when we get ready to take action because we can speak then.
Right.
After they make up their minds.
Yeah. And I'll share your comments with council prior to the workshop, or actually during the workshop, as I present.
Do you need any letters from any of them?
I'll take whatever you want to provide me with.
Does anybody think the it should go away? That's what I'm curious about, because I don't think it should go away.
I don't either. No.
You're talking about the seat
dive. This as a group.
No, the bike ride.
Right, but yeah. Does anybody on the commission feel that?
Well, you want to take an action of this poll?
They're probably all afraid to speak because
are you guys supportive in reducing it?
Just in general, just finding a way to keep it in some way, some fashion.
Yeah I think that maybe making a smaller footprint so it doesn't cost as much to the city, and trying to find, you know, like Commissioner Nyland said, private partnerships to get some of the funding you need to keep it going.
Yeah, okay. I mean, everything about this event is a good feel. Everything that happens on this event is a good feel. Yeah. And did you ever read about Jim McAllister, councilman?
I have not.
Okay. Probably he was gone way before anybody here came on board, but that's because I'm old. But Jim was one of those guys out there. He was leading the pack in the front of the bikes, and he loved biking, you know, and so a lot of people turned up for it. But 900 people doesn't sound like a lot out of a city of 250,000.
Right.
So I would suggest, when you take it to council, the footprint probably is going to be bigger once you get sponsors.
Well,
there's ways to generate more interest, too, in the schools.
Well, we have a huge footprint, Chair and Commissioners, that we currently hold the ride at the Sorrel Ranch Park. It's a huge footprint.
I know.
And we only occupy a small portion of it that we rent.
Did you ever consider...
I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Do you have to rent your section in the park?
We rent the...
We don't. We don't pay.
I was going to say, my God. I've heard stories like that, though, Brown. You know?
We pay for parts on our cars.
I can believe that.
Did you ever consider maybe the fact that you don't get a lot of participation is because you have it on a Sunday morning? And maybe if you had it on a Saturday, you would get more people? Because Sunday, a lot of people here go to church. It's a really hard day to have a big family participation thing.
So that is Dory's world. We experimented, and I'm going to let Dory answer why we do the Sunday.
Well, actually, I wasn't here when we switched it to Saturday.
Oh, you weren't?
This was before Dory, but...
This was before my time, but...
Yeah, we didn't have it 1 year on a Saturday to coincide with the green event that happens at the main library, and actually our ridership went down.
Yeah, but that was a couple of years ago, right?
Yes.
And that was the weekend that it poured rain, wasn't it?
I believe it rained before, but I don't think it rained during that.
I thought it did rain that 1 year that you did it on a Saturday.
So I think what I'm hearing, Chair and Commissioners, is you wish to keep the event in some fashion, but you're not necessarily opposed to scaling it back. You'd like to seek opportunity for sponsorships, and if we can keep it a larger scale event, then do so. But if we don't get the sponsors, are you opposed to scaling back?
It depends on how you go about attracting the sponsors, and I'm going to be a critic on that side because I've done that as my livelihood for 24 years before I started my business. Sponsorships are out there. The way it's presented to them and the return opportunity for their visibility is the key factor with anybody writing a check. So those are the ingredients that have to be on the table when you take it to a sponsor potential. So that's another educational curve for people in City Hall, because most people in the City Hall, with all due respect, they don't go out and ask for sponsors. It's usually the mayor calling up somebody and saying, hey, I want you to do this, okay. You know, but our councilmen, very few councilmen go out and ask for sponsors. So, I mean, the reality of it is, a committee I would venture to say you wouldn't even have to put it out the RFP, but you create a committee within the bicycle group of some type of people who would be willing to head it up and put some investment of time in it, or an RFP where you cost share, because you're going to still get that. Your goal is to raise 50 grand or more. And if that contract says, here's the percentages as you go up on a ladder, each rung is a different percentage of your share. You hit 100,000, this is what you get. You'll see it happen.
So what we have now, Chair and Commissioners, is you are the bicycle group. We no longer have the Citizens Bicycle Advisory Commission.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're now merged with Citizens Transportation Oversight Commission.
I would say, unlike like this committee, the bicyclists in our city are all ages. I see a lot of people that are out there in years, out there bicycling on the streets. So, anyway. For what it's worth, I think you've got our feeling pretty good.
I think so. Ever,
you know,
I think so.
I'm adamant about the city not taking any more thread count down on community.
Well said. Okay, that's all I had on that.
Okay, I think next up is Trevor. pavement management program update.
All right. Where are you going, Robert? He's out of here.
That's what I wanted to say for it. Thanks for making it obvious. I was trying to make a quiet exit. You guys have a great evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
What's that?
Chair Fundis and Commissioners, once again, tonight Trevor will provide the Commission with a pavement management program presentation that was given to Council on September 24th. So this is a follow-up to the last pavement management presentation that we brought to you back in, August. So it has since gone to workshop, and this is the presentation that was given at that time.
Minus our assistant city manager, Chris Anaridian. He was with me. We tag-teamed the presentation. So, Chair Commissioners, thanks for having me tonight. This is the identical presentation that Council received on
September
24th. Thank you very much. And so this is a lengthy presentation. There's 80 slides.
Oh, my.
We're going to cover, basically, we're going to cover what we've done, what we've learned, and where we need to go. It's broken into two parts. The first 40 slides are basically operations, how we do what we do and why do we do it that way. Then the second half, slides 41 through 80, are budget, it's finances. So you'll get the why we do what we do and how we do it, and then you'll get how we spend the money and where we use the money and how much money we need. Okay?
And this is done in 5 minutes?
15.
Where am I?
This is done in 15
minutes. Item 8. I'm sorry. 15.
It says 15?
15.
Oh, 50.
15.
I can do that.
You have 5 seconds to slide. All right.
Okay. Well, I actually just covered 4 slides. What are we doing? What did we learn? Where are we going? In April 2016, staff presented the council that with $77,000, with the approval of $77 million, we feel that we could get the pavement management program back to where it should be in about a 5 to 7 year period. We said we're going to catch up from the lost pavement management program maintenance that we neglected from 2012. We were wrong. We were just wrong. I was wrong. The catch-up phrase is the wrong phrase. There is no catch-up phase. Mm-hmm. The reality is it's maintenance in perpetuity. That's what it is. The maintenance never stops. You put pavement down or asphalt down, you have to maintain it. If you don't maintain it, it degrades to a point that it degrades and we need to replace it. That's what this graph is showing. This is showing the degradation and maintenance cycle life cycle of a roadway. So assuming that on the left you have 0 to 100, you guys have heard me talk about the pavement condition index or the PCI. Mm-hmm. I'll be referring to that in this. So 0 to 100 is the PCI score. And then it goes over time on the bottom, year 1 to year 25. A typical brand new road will last about 21 years, 25 years, depending on multiple factors such as volume, weather, things like that. This is given an illustration of a roadway with about a 90 PCI. And then it goes out. It's good. We want to keep all of our network roadways, the PCI at about a 70 or higher. That's our target. If you recall, in 2015, we had an analysis done of our PCI, network PCI, and it came back at 65.5. We want to increase that to 70 or above. So anything in the yellow or green, we would consider acceptable. If it falls down into the red or below, We need to spend some money quickly on it to bring those roads back up to where we want them to be. Now, don't confuse that. I forgot who mentioned it, but we're not interested in keeping every single road at a PCI of 70 or higher.
That was me.
We're interested in keeping the aggregate at 70 or higher. We might have roads that are at a 30 or a 40. And we might have roads that are at a 90 or 100. We want the aggregate average to be 70 or higher, okay? So if we let a road roll out its life for about a 10-year period, you can see the degradation of it. The PCI goes from approximately, say, 90 down to about a 55. If you don't treat it, it just falls apart and turns into dirt. So what we do is treat it every 5 years. That's what we're presenting to you. We're proposing every 5 years we need to treat that street with something for a nominal investment. Every 5 years we're treating it, and then we extend that life cycle out in that target PCI category for up to about a 25-year period. In theory, if we keep that street treated with the appropriate treatment, we'll never have to do a major investment in it. But if we don't, we have to invest a great deal of money to get the street back up to an acceptable PCI. And then we're supposed to treat it before it degrades again. So what we're doing is we have a little bit of both going on in Glendale right now. We're investing money on the topical treatments or the less invasive treatments, and we're investing a great deal of money in the larger or more invasive treatments, such as a reconstruction or a mill and overlay. The point here is we need to get them into the green and treat them every 5 years appropriately. So we told council back in 2016, we're going to touch every street. And we're going to get our PCI up from 65 to 72. How do we know? How do we know that we're doing the right thing? How do we know that we're putting the right treatment on the right road at the right time for the right price with the right contractor? We hire a consultant to go out with their super fancy scanners, these vans that are highly technological, and they go out and read the condition of the streets. I have a series of videos I'm going to be playing. They're short videos, so this will give an explanation of how PCI is read. I hope.
Take a look at this van. It is basically a fancy mobile scanner. It measures pavement conditions. The Pavement Condition Index, or PCI for short, measures roadway deterioration and distress. The results help determine what types of pavement management treatments might be used.
Okay, so we use that to help identify what treatment to put on what road, at what time, for what price, with what contractor. Mm-hmm. Okay, this illustration is identifying the various treatments that we use. There's many more than this, but this is the fundamental categories of treatments that we use. The green bars that are on the outside of these circles are representation of money. The smaller the green, the less money it costs. The more the green, like over in full reconstruction, that's by far the most expensive type of treatment. Crack sealing on the top left is the cheapest type of treatment. So now we're going to go through videos to identify what each treatment is for and when we use it. Oops, let me go back. Got it.
Hello, I am Javier Garola, Principal Engineer of Transportation, and I am Dan Gearhart, Project Manager with the Engineering Department. We are here to tell you about the various types of treatments we have in our pavement management toolbox. First up is asphalt patchwork. This is a highly successful pre-treatment measure that fills all major existing potholes and other pavement deformities. Asphalt patchwork removes deteriorated pavement and replaces it with new asphalt. This is a must-use prior to other treatments like seal coating, slurry sealing, fast, or cape seal.
That treatment is done, that's the prep work. That's done on almost every single street that we put down some sort of a pavement management treatment on. We always find some sort of edge that needs to be repaired or a pothole that needs to be filled, so that work gets completed then. Now we'll move into crack sealing.
Crack seal is another highly successful pre-treatment measure that fills in all major existing cracks and is a must-use prior to seal coating, slurring, fast, or cape seal. As you can see, a rubberized material shoots out of a handheld wand directly into the crack and is spread flush with the pavement to force the material into the cracks and leaves a smooth surface once complete.
That again is done almost prior to every treatment that we put down.
And they do it very fast.
They do it very fast. Next is slurry seal. Slurry seal is one of the more common treatments that you see on our streets as well. I have to wait for the cursor to come up. There we go.
Slurry seal is a surface treatment of polymer-modified emulsified asphalt with aggregate that is spread directly onto the road surface in one or two coats. Its main objective is to protect against UV and rain, but it also provides a skid-resistant surface.
Polymer emulsified aggregate something or other. Did you guys catch all that?
Polymer.
Okay. Right. Next is seal coat.
Seal coating is a surface treatment of polymer and or latex modified emulsified asphalt that is sprayed directly onto the road surface in two coats. The main objective of a seal coat is to protect against UV and rain.
Can everyone hear okay?
I can hear it.
Mm-hmm. I can hear it.
FAST. This is a fractured aggregate.
FAST stands for Fractured Aggregate Surface Treatment. As the name implies, it is a surface made up of hot rubber asphalt binder that is sprayed on the existing roadway, that is followed by spreading and rolling of pre-coated fractured rock. This treatment creates a bridge over the existing surface and adds a structural element to the overall pavement section. FAST can be followed by any type of light oil or seal coat layer.
Very effective treatment. Cape seal. Cape seal is the treatment that we're now using in place of mill and overlay.
Cape seal is a surface treatment where a FAST layer is applied, followed by a slurry seal layer. It is a good cost-effective alternative to a mill and overlay and can have a life cycle of 10 plus years. Starting with this treatment and moving forward, ADA improvements are required.
Cape seal is about 25% the price or cost of a mill and overlay. Now there's a thin overlay.
Thin overlay is a highly successful surface treatment. It involves rolling out of a 2-inch layer of hot asphalt directly onto the existing road surface. Edge milling of the existing surface is required to create a flush finished surface. It has the longest life cycle as compared to previously mentioned treatments.
Now the full mill and overlay.
Mill and overlay is a highly successful surface treatment. In this process, we mill out a layer of hot asphalt deeper than 2 inches. It is then replaced with a new layer of asphalt rolled onto the road surface, leaving a very smooth driving surface.
That was just recently done on Sweetwater between 59th and 67th. Now our surface reconstructions.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Lifespan of the mill overlay?
7 to 10 years.
So for 25% of that cost, with Cape Seal, we get the same?
Yes.
Interesting.
That was my question, too.
Yeah, I'll share more. We'll get through this last video here.
Full reconstruction is almost always successful in that it involves full replacement of the roadway prism from the asphalt surface all the way to the native base. Materials are imported and compacted back in place. The final road surface may either be a hot asphalt mix or a Portland cement concrete pavement.
And the thing that we really want to protect is the bedding underneath the asphalt. Once the asphalt gets holes in it and the bedding gets penetrated with water, that's when the road falls apart. That's when we have to reconstruct. So we talked about these different treatments. I wanted to tell you that these can be mixed in a manner that there's thousands of combinations of these treatments. They're getting better and better all the time. And we're learning the last few years, we're learning that these products are better than ever. They're continuously improving, and we have infinite combinations of materials to use. So to date, we've completed 304 miles of our 748 miles. We have 444 to go, so we're not quite halfway. and we've learned some things. So what have we learned? We learned some effective treatments of our pavements, the applications that we use. We're using our staff experience. We used to have a different focal point of what we were going to do. We thought we're going to touch every street and increase the PCI. Well, we're resetting that. Our focus is really, we need to maintain a network PCI of 70 or above. We'll have some low streets, we'll have some high streets, but we need to maintain, increase our PCI average. So our mission drift has been refocused. We've learned that we need to communicate better. There's been several instances where signs have been deployed in neighborhoods. People have received mailers, barricades have been deployed, and no treatments have been put down due to miscommunication or confusion or poor scheduling or the weather. So we know, we recognize that we need to increase our communication to our, all the residents, mayor and council, and our internal and external customers. And we also need to recognize when the expectations aren't met. So the touch every street is really a tactic to meet the objective of increasing the PCI. The goal is to increase the network PCI. So we've done something recently. We had a consultant go out with their scanner and complete an assessment of our existing network PCI. At the time that this presentation was put together, that assessment wasn't completed. They were only about 58% complete. And the streets that they read, they found the yellow arrows there. They show that the PCIs have dropped substantially, telling us if the streets aren't treated, they're going to degrade rapidly. But the good news is the green arrows, the streets that we've touched, the PCIs have increased actually more than we thought they would. So that's a good news item. Mm-hmm. So right there, the arterials, they've increased by six points, and the residentials have increased by 11 points. Based on that 58% completion, the network average went from 65 down to 59. We suspect that's going to be different after the 100% completion has been calculated. So to date, we've spent $50 million since 2015 on the pavement management program.
Is that out of the 77 that was allocated?
And then some. So it's not, it's only a portion of the 77 million. Mm-hmm. So some things that we learned here with this, this is the seal coating. We learned that the prep work shows through the topical treatment. It might not be as aesthetically pleasing as our customers want. But to note, it does meet the PCI. It is functioning properly. It's doing what we wanted it to do. It may not just be as pretty as we wanted it to be. Oops, I meant that one. You can see the cracks that are showing through. So it's still functional, it's preserving. Yes, sir.
Trevor, I'm noticing, like I go down 43rd almost every day. I'm noticing it is looking better on the Glendale side.
Good.
Than the Phoenix side.
Good. That's great. Did you guys all hear that? Okay. This is the FAST, the fractured aggregate surface treatment. And the picture on the left would be an ideal condition. The two pictures on the right, you can see there's some discrepancies there. We had a patch treatment that should have been done prior to this FAST being applied. And on the right, some of the crack sealing is showing through the FAST. So we've learned maybe some additional prep work can prevent the aesthetics from showing through. This is a slurry seal that went down left turn lane at 51st Avenue southbound at Camelback. And we identified here that the slurry didn't settle properly, and so it showed these slick-looking marks We actually, through our quality assurance program with our inspectors, we were able to capture this, get the contractor back on site that applied this product, and they redid it at their cost before the warranty expired. Which almost transitions us into our quality controls. So some adjustments that we've made. We need to look at our PCI more frequently. We've been doing it every 3 or 4 years. We need to do it every year. We're making a huge investment on the taxpayers' money, and we need to know that we're on track, that we're accomplishing the goals that we're stating that we're going to accomplish. So what the magic number is, should we break the city into zones and do a zone at every year? Should we break it in the quarters? We don't quite know yet what's the appropriate amount of money. Maybe it's after every major milestone, we put down 100 miles of treatment, we measure the PCI. Maybe that's how we do it, but the point is we need to measure more frequently than we have been. We need to improve our products with the roadways so that we achieve the desired outcomes. We talked about enhancing our communications, and we need to maintain or increase our quality controls. And how do we do that? Well, what we're currently doing is we're measuring our control before, during, and after each product gets deployed or applied to the roadways. We have 4 inspectors on our pavement management program, and each product that is applied, let's use slurry as an example, each product follows the MAG spec, the Maricopa County or Maricopa Association of Governments specification. It's a unified approved spec that we follow. So our contractors, when they produce or provide us with the slurry, they provide us with a certification sheet that it meets the designated specification. Then they get out onto the job site, and before they deploy the product, they present the inspector with that certified sheet stating that the product that's in the truck meets the spec. Then the product gets laid down, and while it gets laid down, the inspector goes to the computer readouts or the gauges on the truck and ensure that the mixtures are appropriately set for the application of the product. Then they can also use a tape measure and measure the rake, the deployment method, if it's supposed to be 5 inches or less from the asphalt surface and it's at 6, they'll have the contractor adjust it and start over. So that's their quality assurance during the process. After the process, a slurry seal typically has a 1 year or 12 month warranty period. So the inspectors do a walkthrough with the contractor at the completion of the deployment, identify any flaws, and create what we call a punch list. And the contractor has to complete those punch list items before we'll sign off on the application. Prior to the 12-month expiration of the warranty, they go back out, the inspector and the contractor, and walk the site again. And such as the incident with 51st Avenue and Camelback, they identify something's not right, the contractor has to fix it on their own dime. So now, some enhancements that we're making to our quality assurance is our inspectors are also reading our signs that get deployed. We've had some misspelled signs out there. So they're reading the signs. The barricades aren't being deployed 2-3 weeks in advance anymore. Mm. Now they're being deployed 2-3 days in advance. So residents aren't going to be calling saying, why are there barricades on our streets and no treatments being put down? So we've enhanced that. We also have the contractors now have to submit a traffic control plan to our barricade management team, identifying all the barricades they're seeking to deploy, along with the signs that they want to put out. So our inspectors are seeing that prior to deployment. So where are we going? We're about halfway through this now. Where are we going? Well, we're asking council to look beyond the 10-year period and go back into a 25-year period. We tried this in the past unsuccessfully. We're trying it again because it's important, because there's some financial data that they need to be aware of in the out years. So now we're getting into the financial graphs. I think we're on slide 41 here. So what's happening? I'm going to cover what our revenues are, and then we're going to cover what our expenses are, and we'll compare them. So our revenue sources, we have general obligation bond money that the council approved for us for the street reconstructions. We have our airport special revenues. This is all going to add up into one major line. We have our street development impact fee structure, our public transportation funds and our Arizona lottery funds, our highway user revenue funds and barricade revenue, and our transportation sales tax along with its interest and the fare box revenue. All those total that big green line. Now we're going to break it down a little bit to do some comparison for you. Our pavement management alone, we have programmed in the out years from basically FY25 out to 2044, $5.2 million per year. That's not near enough. But you can see what the pavement cost is. So just in the 10 years, we're going to be spending about $108 million on pavement alone. The big reason we want to take out to the 25 years is in 2033, we get back previous debt service for the transportation tax. We get back $7 million of, or we get rid of $7 million of debt. We don't gain more revenue, but we get rid of debt. So in 2033, we get that $7 million that we can reappropriate to pavement management. So when we do that, we take it out 25 years, we're going to be spending about $300 million on pavement management alone. Excuse me. Now we're going to add in the additional expenses. We add in right-of-way maintenance, add in our street maintenance and barricade management, along with our lighting, street lights, and some of our other divisions. And this is our bus, our transit system. It's huge. This is the fixed route, the big buses, the City of Phoenix contract. And this is our dialer ride that's associated with the fixed route. And our airport. Our airport is interesting because we're flirting with a break-even point on the airport. So it's almost sustainable. So the big green line on top is all of our combined revenues, and the gold line that overlaps it is all of our combined expenses. As you can see, there's some good areas and bad areas. The red is bad, the green is good. So what council has historically been doing is looking at 10 years. So in our current 10-year program, if you can see in that light green area, things look pretty good. We look like we're pretty well balanced. We've absorbed some, we paid some of the initial overages with our fund balance. And then we look like we're net positive. But when you go out 25 years, we need a lot more money for the pavement program or for the transportation program. Now, what we've done to calculate what we actually need, we're going to get into what we truly need for our pavement program. $5.2 million, isn't it? We've calculated what we really need for our pavement program with 152 million square feet of asphalt or roadway. We're currently spending $5.2 million a year, or that's what we have programmed to spend. That's 3.4 cents per square foot. It's far from adequate, and there's no inflation factor associated with it. Mm-hmm. Through the industry standards, the actual textbook life cycle of a roadway, and what realistically we are expecting and what our regional partners are practicing, we need about 11.6 cents per square foot for pavement. What does that mean? That's $17.7 million per year that we need for pavement alone. We're about $12 million short. So now we look at our graph of our revenues versus expenses, and the pink area is the reality of what we really need for our roadways. So it's the pink plus the gray. So what's that going to do? Now, our green line is our revenue. The red line that overlaps with the green is our old expense line. But with the addition of the reality of what we really need for pavement, that's being bumped up to the new gold line. So we need a lot more money for pavement. Now all that revenue that we had is exhausted and we need much more. So there's a deficit there over the 25 years of about $520 million. What can we do? What can we do to help that? Well, we can potentially cap transit at a set inflation rate. That's challenging to do, but it's potential. So we presented it. We can potentially cap it at 3%. The high line there is a 9% inflation rate. That's what we've been experiencing approximately for our fixed route, the big buses, the City of Phoenix contract through Valley Metro for transit, about a 9% inflation rate. If we cap it at 3%, then we can control costs a little better. Same with Dial-A-Ride. Dial-A-Ride is associated with the fixed route. So if we cap Dial-A-Ride at 3% rather than 9%, that provides us with some savings. What impacts would that have on us? Now it moves that red down to a little bit more manageable deficit. Takes it from about $520 million down to $227 million. So how do we close that gap, the $227 million gap, if we're able to cap transit? We're very near the end. So what we can do is we can draw down our reserve, our remaining fund balance. We can use the remaining fund balance to help fill in that void there where the arrow is pointed to. We can also look at projections for development throughout Glendale. Nobody does it. Nobody looks at those projections. Maybe we should. We don't look at our growth projections for revenue. Maybe we should. The Highway User Revenue Program, the Highway User Revenue Fund, or the HERF program, needs to be revisited globally. It's not just a Glendale effort, it's a global effort. And that formula needs to change. We have all these new electric vehicles coming online. That's going to buy less gas. That means less revenue. So we need to reevaluate that formula. But the only thing that we have on this board with any control over is the general fund contribution. If we want to close that gap anymore, we need some general fund support. So what we're going to do is we're going to come back to council with recommended actions such as reallocating our debt payments in 2033, that's a $7 million debt, back into the pavement program. We're going to propose capping Dial-A-Ride and fixed route, and then managing our fund balance across the board to help close the gap. And then we'll return to council on a future workshop with additional suggestions of what we can do and what support we might foresee needed from the general fund. I think that is slide number 80. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions. Am I over the 15 minutes?
14 and a half.
Okay.
You're fine. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
What about the council's mentality toward the bond market and the bonding, your needs for 25 years rather than the short-term bonds? Has that been addressed or looked at?
It's being explored. Chair and Commissioner, that is being explored. So it needs much more work done, but it is an option that's on the table, and we'll likely present that to council.
Okay, let me ask the question a little differently. Is council receptive to a more aggressive bond approach to these issues that we have as a city?
I would say yes. We haven't specifically asked that, but in our conversations and recent council action in bond discussions, I think the temperature is yes, they would be receptive.
Well, the climate is better right now.
Right.
Because our ratings are at the top end of the best.
Right.
So now's the time to strike, if you will.
Right. there's a trick to that, though.
Yep.
And I might need Prev to help articulate. The bonding can only be used for reconstructions. I don't think bonding can be used for maintenance applications. Mm-hmm. 99% of what we're doing is maintenance.
I appreciate what you just said. However, reclassification of product that's out there, mm-hmm. based on your surveys that you just have, when you're complete with your full analysis with these trucks that have all the technology, let's say you come in at 70%, that is way below.
Right.
Or 60 or whatever. Can that be used as a replacement part of the formula?
So, if I can.
Go ahead.
So, surface treatments, so everything that is not reconstruction, if you remember the bubbles,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the last two bubbles, which is surface reconstruction and complete reconstruction, those would be eligible for bond funds. And in fact, if you remember the first revenues that were identified towards the transportation program by general obligation.
Right.
So there are bond funds going towards reconstructions,
mm-hmm.
And there's some cash going towards reconstructions, but the surface treatments, the rest of them, because the life of them is shorter than the life of the deck.
Yes. Right.
So it's like taking a loan for your tires,
yeah.
that may last 5 years, but your loan lasts 20 years. Or so our treatments last 5 years.
Yeah.
We have to go back and do another treatment. If we start borrowing for that, and we'll have a challenge even getting someone to accept that
right.
as a bonding.
In the bond,
not
the bond.
Right.
Yes.
The practice is not the bond for anything
right.
less than a 20-year life.
Right, mm-hmm. I understand that. When you look at the Palo Verde example of what they had to go through, and the Three Mile example, which is shut down, and a loss of millions, the streets are something that, I mean, if you had brand new structure, it'd be wonderful. But streets, without the maintenance, have no life.
Right.
They're going to decay and die.
Right.
So is that something that has to be reformulated or restructured for the bond market to accept?
I think a lot of these are IRS ways.
It's a matter of sustainability. So we have our revenue streams, right? So
right.
if we bond towards these maintenance kind of activities, after one or two cycles, your bond debt payments will outdo you. You'll basically not have any more bonding capacity to do any more maintenance. So now your cash is all going towards debt, so you can't even borrow anymore, and now you have ongoing maintenance activities every 5 years that you need to do.
Okay.
So you just eat away that capacity. There's only so much bonding capacity. The 7 million that we have, initially when we issued the bonds in 2008, the goal was we were trying to issue a 15-year bond. But when we went out to the bond market, they said, you actually, the amount of bonding that you have built into your program is not sustainable. So they made us make it a 25-year bond.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we bond towards maintenance activities like the surface treatment, in a short period, we'll run out of bonding capacity in our
mm-hmm.
program. And we won't have the ability to pay cash or bond funds towards future treatment.
Interesting. Catch 22 type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So the HERF funds probably going to take a major hit.
Right.
In the next 10 years.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of some comments that council made for your information. Councilman Turner asked the question if we could seek to modify or investigate research to modify the requirement for ADA improvements when we get to the seal coat level of our applications. We're required to do mm-hmm. concrete improvements, the ADA ramps. So Councilman Turner is asking us to research if that can be adjusted, because realistically we'll never be able to keep up with the ADA improvements because they change every 18 months approximately. So it's going to be very difficult to keep up with ADA compliance in that manner.
Yep.
Do you remember some other comments that... Do you guys have any other questions that...
Do you feel comfortable right now with the support you have at the elected body of council in for your department needs?
Chair and commissioners, yes. Yes. But it's complicated because there's... We touched on the pavement, you know, and there's multiple divisions within transportation, mm-hmm. and where those demands are truly at could offset. It could inflate that deficit from what we had to control at $227 million back up to $500-600 million. We don't know for sure, but I can tell you that council appreciated this presentation, and we get the sense, you guys help me out, but I got the sense that they understood and were sympathetic, concerned, and supportive in what we need.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
So you have an educated body.
Yes.
And they seem relevant in their positions, which is good.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Was council open to get funding this from the general fund? So if they give us $2 million over 10 years, we'll cover the deficit. That's something we talked about.
Chair and commissioners, I think they'd be receptive to it, but we didn't broach that subject at the workshop. Mm-hmm. We need to come back. Bullet number 5. Mm-hmm. We're tasked to return to them with suggestions such as that. Even our internal staff, our budget director, we're discussing how we can close that gap, how we can present it to council, and we're trying to find internally before we even get to the workshop what options we have and how we can close the gaps. But that's definitely something that's in discussion.
Yeah, Trevor, would you say that this? I'm thinking out loud here. But the roadways, of course, if I was an elected official and the roads are not where they should be, that's one thing I'm going to hear from the constituents. So they're going to hear that. The praise comes less than the other side, of course. So the end result here is the capital fund, as it grows with surplus, the council receptiveness to maybe making a heavier contribution might as well grow. So... with this surplus we have right now, as we continue with that surplus, this department or this part of the city has to be one of the major issues on the minds of council as far as how to deal with it. I'm just guessing. Water and sewer is a different issue, but this issue here, it's a no user fee, you know, so we don't pay you so much a month on our tax bill.
Right.
So it's the council really has a lot of responsibility in this, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
We're approaching 15 minutes.
Thank you for that on behalf of myself. Thank you for the report. I mean, yeah. Very informative and well positioned. And the council receptivity is really the issue.
Yeah. And I think it was a positive reception.
Yeah.
Last question I had. So the cost allocation plan we heard about last month that. Transportation department incurs a general fund charge for various overhead and such. Does the fact that 10,000 other cars use the city roads go into that calculation? Should some money be coming back transportation's way to account for that?
From the general fund?
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's a source of, just in the same sense that you use HR department's resources, those other departments are using your resources.
I
like that.
Let's talk to our legal team about that.
There'll be an alert go out in the morning on the email.
That's a great, Chair, that's, Commissioners, that's a good suggestion. We'll note that.
Any other questions? Thank you, Trevor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So next we have the manager's reports. As a reminder, this is information only, so I'm not allowed to pepper for all the questions.
This will be a quick and sharp one. Northern Parkway, DISA 211th, the project that's under construction, particularly the Agafia Bridge. I mentioned it at the last meeting. Completion mm-hmm. is scheduled for August 2020. The new piece of information that I have today is the Agafia Bridge itself will be complete by January of 2020. Mm-hmm. So that's the new piece of information. Those of you who drove here from the west mm-hmm. probably noticed that 67th Avenue, there's some construction work going on. And if you've driven along Orange Wood, there's construction going along Orange Wood as well. So 67th and Orange Wood, 67th from Glendale to Orange Wood, and Orange Wood from 67th to Grand Avenue. They will all be receiving sidewalks. There'll be continuous sidewalks on both sides, curb gutter, and a half street improvement on Orange Wood just east of 67th Avenue. So that is under construction. And there's one other item. This is an annual boards and commissions appreciation mm-hmm. event. So most of you, I think, are aware of this. If anyone's new, the date is December 19th. It's the Minnesota Wild. You'll get more information in an email from Patrick. He'll try to coordinate the, I believe you and a guest is generally the practice. So you'll get all that information in an email, then you can collect them, and you can collect them and all that. But just note the date. Don't have any other plans for that evening.
Thank you.
And that is all for the manager. Wow.
Thank you.
Sure. That might have been within 15 minutes.
I think that was fine.
he was only about five.
Oh. Yeah.
Who assigns the times on these? Who's in charge of making those up? Is that you, Patrick?
Patrick.
Chair Fundus and Commissioners, in my defense, the presentation for the pavement management changed a little bit over the last couple of days. Time expectation changed as well.
Item 10, commission and staff updates. I'll open the floor to any commissioners who would like to share any information obtained from outside sources or discussions with citizens or any other information. Commissioner Nyland.
I had the pleasure of being in Kansas City, Missouri in the last 3 weeks, and I'm happy to report their light rail is expanding dramatically from down by the river through the old market area up into the city, into the southern part of the city, going to the Country Club Plaza. This is a city, by the way, that's only 1 million people with five counties, but the actual population is 500,000. So it's twice the size of Glendale. And so they voted, of course, to tax themselves to build the light rail. The piece that I wanted to share that I thought was ironic is that, I hate to say this, but 65 years ago, I rode streetcars with wires and trolley lines all over the city for a dime, okay? And they took them all out. Mm-hmm. Of course, they put new buses on that didn't have anything but engines. And they took all the street rails out and everything else. Now they're putting them back in the same road, going right back down where I used to live. So it's interesting how things come around. It took 65 years. But an interesting piece is the ridership's way up on that piece of transportation in a city that's kind of got a lot of hills and a diverse community of ethnicity. So it's not necessarily for the rich, but it's for everybody, and it's been well received. So just to share that with you. And it's not a city of huge skyscrapers either, not like Seattle and all that's going on there. But less people are riding or driving their cars. They're riding the opportunity for mass transit. So it's kind of cool.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Anybody else have anything to share? With that, we'll move to future agenda items. We should have a printout of tentative upcoming items. Are there any suggestions for any additional items?
Was the November agenda the electric vehicle charging station? Is that another piece? Or was that done tonight?
That would be, what we're thinking is we're going to build on tonight.
Okay.
And then, and whether it's November, or it just depends on as the information comes into us. But yeah, the expectation is we'll continue
gotcha.
On the topic.
Great, okay.
I think the commission will want an update on the family bike ride.
Good point.
And we'll find things. I think if that is going to happen, it would be starting the planning process very soon.
Yes.
Yes,
it's already underway.
No other comments on agenda items? Okay, next meeting. Next meeting will be November 7th. I assume that's Thursday at 6 o'clock in this building. With that, we're adjourned.